Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. So, some interesting news I just came across. Andrew Yang, you remember we had him on, it's been a while since I had him on. I had him on a couple of times. Running for president, a tech guy, former tech executive. I guess he founded Venture for America. Evidently, he's the first Democrat to qualify for the primary debates. He has 65,000 unique donors, and I guess that's one of the big criteria. So Andrew Yang, as of now, the only person who qualifies for the Democratic debates. I wish him well, because look, I think he's got a great platform. I think the guaranteed minimum income or universal basic, however you want to frame that, I think it's a great idea. And also talking about, you know, automation and what it's going to mean to our lives. Somebody finally bringing that up. So good stuff. Good. Let's get to the news. Luke Vargas, Talk Media News. Luke, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, I'm excited about this big debate stage. And it looks like Mayor Pete Buttigieg is also making waves. If $500,000 or $600,000 in donations over the last few days counts, then I think it does. I mean, you know, these are people who are really finding a way to get into the process. And I'm very glad the DNC made a change in the admission rules to the debate, because that's always been a real pain point for me in the system, you know, about how people can never really break through unless you're already in Congress, and we know what that takes. So I'm liking what I'm seeing so far.
No, I am too. And look, I said from the beginning, and this is going back a year and a half now, anticipating what is coming. I think we should do it like March Madness. I think there should be, like a field of 64. They have debate offs and they move on to the next round. You get to the Sweet 16. You move on to the Elite Eight. I think that's the way to go. I don't want to see a stage of 60 people. So I think one-on-one debates, and I think that's the way to go.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, I think there's so many candidates that need name recognition and exposure at this point that it actually might work that you're not going to see people saying, oh, well, if I can't get on the main stage, I'm out. People will say, yeah, whatever it takes. If I have to share the stage with, one of these sort of second tier candidates, fine, so long as it means some airtime. So I think this could work out.
Yeah, one of the guys I liked, Richard Ojeda, the former state senator from West Virginia.
He's out now, right?
He was in. Now he was in for like 15 minutes. We had him on, and then he was out. but he was one of those guys who I like his passion. I like his vision. I think it's a conversation. It's conversations we need to be having about the direction of the party. But sadly, as he said, look, he didn't want to take people's money and have nowhere to go with it. So I respect that. But I still think part of the process is getting all voices out there.
Yeah.
Let's get into it. Another plane crash. It seems like just about everybody except the U.S. and Canada banning these MAX jets. What's going on?
Yeah, no, I think it's really worth pointing out that this Boeing 737 MAX 8 has been a sort of a turnaround aircraft for Boeing, which had been long competing with Airbus for these sort of medium haul aircraft, single aisle jets, which populate a lot of routes in the U.S. And in the eastern parts of China. I mean, the geography is pretty similar. I mean, people are moving from population centers roughly equivalent in China, at least sort of Boston to Miami and routes like that. And so you've seen Boeing really make a ton of money in the past few years by releasing this aircraft as a direct competitor to an Airbus product. And it's been one of the main reasons Boeing has been so successful. I forget the exact numbers, but I read something, I think on Sunday evening, it said, wish I could pull up this statistic. It would be a great one to give to your listeners. But it was something along the lines of that Boeing's sort of rise in market cap over the last few years represents something like 30% of the U.S. S&P 500 growth. I mean, we were really talking about one of the predominant drivers of U.S. exports right now. When you look at the trade deficit statistics that came out last week, there's a whole line item for U.S. airline exports. It's that big. I mean, we're talking about billions and billions and billions of dollars here. So, I think that is something you have to keep in mind, that there is this sort of U.S. or sort of Boeing versus Airbus versus soon to be a Chinese competitor to the Boeing jet, standoff, which is sort of in the background here. And I think it makes people a little suspicious as they look at the countries now, which include India, China, the entire European Union, a bunch of other countries in Southeast Asia and the Middle East, who have said, we're not going to allow this jet to fly on our national carriers, and we're, in many cases, not even going to allow it into our airspace, conspicuous that the U.S. is the only country that hasn't really made this move. And again, not the only, but the biggest operator of these planes is the one also, and the host country of the airline manufacturer is the one to keep these planes in the sky. Even weirder, I think, is that the FAA seems to have conceded that Airbus does need to fix something. You know, they're not saying, oh, there's no problems at all. In fact, they've given Airbus, or rather Boeing, a demand that they have to release some sort of patch or software fix on this by April, which, again, would imply that something is wrong and needs fixing. And if we're only talking about a few weeks, I think people, by and large, the flying public, and again, there's reasons why the flying public doesn't decide safety things, but they might say, okay, fine, that's worth it. I'll take a 20-minute delay, or I'll, you know, I'd rather be on a different flight, and the U.S. is holding back here. And I noticed this morning Elizabeth Warren putting out a statement which basically said, look, you know, we don't know the cause of this, but I think there are some concerns that these planes were basically pressed into service without enough training, and that was a financial decision. And she also pointed to, you know, or alleging that one of the reasons the U.S. has, for instance, been so hesitant to us, or the White House, frankly, has been so hesitant to cede to congressional pressure to stop certain arms sales to Saudi Arabia is because we want to make sure Boeing continues to be able to sell its defense equipment there. So is there some sort of overarching, you know, either sort of American protectionist interest, or even more, you know, concerning, a much more direct sort of financial connection between Boeing and the White House that could be leading to political pressure to the FAA to keep these planes in the sky? I think it's too early to figure that out, but we are hearing calls from Ted Cruz to launch an inquiry in the Senate subcommittees on transportation, and evidently, I think, some legislative efforts that might be underway involving people like Elizabeth Warren and, across the aisle, Mitt Romney, to try and order the FAA to ground these planes. So this is not over yet, and I would point out that the FAA has changed its tune quite a bit in even just the last few hours. So it does seem like they are responding to a climate that, they are responding to a climate that is not very sympathetic to their decision to keep these planes in the sky. So this could all change.
Yeah, all it's going to take is one plane to crash here.
Yeah, I mean,
and hopefully I'm not on
even. Yeah, and even I wish I had the data, but there are hundreds of these planes operating every day, flying many, many routes, and we've seen two crashes, you know, in multiple years of these planes being in the sky. Right. So again, the numerical risks, you know, to any one plane are probably very, very low, just like the aircraft safety statistics are stellar when you compare them to things like driving or riding a bike. But at the same time, you're right, that would, boy, it's hard to even imagine the kind of criticism, rightfully so, that they would be opened up to if they decided to keep these things in operation and we see another accident.
Is it possible, because do we know what caused the crashes of the other two? I mean, is it possible that, one, they just didn't know what the hell they were doing, or two, poorly maintained, or three, some kind of, because you had mentioned, you know, a Chinese entrance into the airline, into the plane building, aviation building, some nefarious thing? I mean, because there's part of me that goes, it just seems kind of curious. That you bang, bang, you got two right in a row, and you got all this other stuff going on. Or maybe it's just that I'm so now jaded that I look at this and go, you know, could it be something else?
I haven't seen those allegations, though I would say if I looked, I would probably find them, not necessarily because they're true, but you know, the world of aviation accidents is a lot
of conspiracy, sure.
Conspiracy theorists. That said, though, I am very concerned that we are in an environment here, in caused, I think, by President Trump, that we are now taking an agency like the FAA, which has long had a pretty stellar reputation with the American public for, you know, being quite exacting in the standards that it insists upon for the aviation industry, and has made, I think, global aviation so much safer because American standards have become global in many ways, that we are now even thinking it's possible that, you know, Boeing's extraordinary financial leverage over politicians, including those in the White House, could be leading to that agency shortcutting safety concerns in favor of corporate influence. Again,
we'll see.
I don't. Yeah. It's too early to say, but it's worrisome that the faith in American institutions has degraded so much that we can't rule that out, or that their minds go there in the first place.
Welcome to the era of Trump. Let's move on. Brexit, I guess gone, done. What's going on?
Oh, yeah, I bet people in the UK wish it were, even if they didn't vote for Brexit in the first place. I mean, this is such a mess. It's really shambolic what we're seeing here. Just once again, Theresa May presenting a deal which she claimed was a improved deal from the one that got absolutely slaughtered in a parliamentary vote in January. And as one Tory MP said, this is a, quote, polished turd, though maybe the best turd we've got, end quote, which is literally the quote of the week, and maybe just perfectly encapsulates Brexit better than anything I've heard in a long time. I mean, it's remarkable. We saw a 149 vote debt loss for Theresa May. So her bill to try and get her version of Brexit through got fell short by 149 votes. With setting up sort of a three-night process here where, so that vote was today, Tuesday, 7 p.m. in London. Tomorrow, 7 p.m. in London, is a second vote, which is not on her bill, but a no-deal Brexit, which would be sort of the free-fall version of a Brexit where nothing is in place on March 29th, but you do it anyways and you live with the consequences. I don't think the numbers exist for that either, which means there's a third vote. This is like an American Idol finale or something. Third vote. On Thursday, we think also at 7 p.m. In London, where they will vote to possibly extend Article 50, which is the sort of treaty way of triggering Brexit, that they would postpone the whole exit from the European Union as they try to figure out what the heck to do here. But even that, I mean, so here, that this whole process is, I think, the way these three votes are lined up, supposed to give the impression that there's some sort of, you know, stewardship of this process, that there's like a steady hand behind the wheel. And yet the fact that so many different sort of options, which are wildly different, are all being put on the table and are just up to the lawmakers to vote for, suggests Theresa May hasn't cracked this code at all. And even if there is a move to delay Brexit, it's not clear if that would clear anything up either. It could be a short delay, which, you know, would probably not lead to very many improvements to the deal, or a long delay, which then could open up the prospect that Labour would call for a general election, maybe try to call for a second referendum. It's, you know, again, 2 weeks away, all options still seem to be possible, which is just extraordinary considering that we've been, you know, 2 years before Brexit. It still seemed like time was running out, 2 months. Here we are, 2 weeks, and I would not be surprised if we end up, you know, 2 days away from Brexit and there's still just flipping as much confusion. Yeah, and it's worth pointing out there are a good number of people who are actually probably rooting for that, insofar as they think the number of votes in Parliament will shift in favor of Theresa May's proposal if they wait long enough and the alternative looks gruesome. And they're thinking from, you know, hardcore Brexiteers that the European Union, which has thus far been very inflexible in giving concessions to Britain, would also sort of cave at the last minute. So they're very much inclined to just keep, you know, driving faster and faster towards this cliff on the thinking that things will suddenly tip their way at the 11th or 12th hour. But boy, I mean, if that doesn't happen, the costs for Britain are going to be great.
Yeah. Or they're planning on the Chinese building of a bridge.
Yeah.
Right. And looking at the one they built in California. Not so thrilled. Speaking of Chinese and bridges and infrastructure, evidently Italy is defying American pressure to sign an agreement with the Chinese to build some infrastructure.
Yeah, this is the Chinese One Belt, One Road initiative, which they sort of harken back to the historical Silk Road pathways that connected traders all across Eurasia, you know, spanning Western Europe all the way to, you know, coastal cities in what was then China. And, you know, what they're basically doing, and your listeners definitely know about this, and we've talked about it before, but they're, you know, basically targeting dozens of countries around the Middle East and Central Asia and Europe and trying to bring them on board with this sort of international infrastructure plan. It means different things to different places. And in some places it means, hey, give us, as China, greater market access, and in exchange we will build a road for you or build some sort of infrastructure that we can use exclusively. In other places, it means, hey, allow us to bid to buy your ports or your airports or things like that. And that's what's happening in Italy's case. It looks like what China may want to do is sort of have a Western terminus point for this international trade route and have it in the port of Trieste, which is at the very tip of the Adriatic. And I think on one hand, the Italian government, which I'll point out is a far-right government that the Trump administration has been quite supportive of, and that people like Steve Bannon are really happy are coming into office and questioning the European Union and things of that sort. They are looking at this and say, look, it's great, market access. You know, we'll get to trade our products far and wide, blah, blah, blah. Foreign investment is great. On the other hand, they're, you know, the U.S. and people in Brussels at the European Union are very nervous that this undermines NATO, because you might have the possibility of a Chinese state-run firm buying up a major piece of infrastructure in a NATO country, and possibly even in the future stationing military hardware there, which would be a real soft and exploited underbelly of NATO in a continental Europe. But also that, these governments, particularly Italy and Hungary under that country's far-right government, are eager to sort of make deals with China almost purposefully to undermine European Union unity, that there has been this EU talking point for a long time, and the U.S. used to believe in this too with TPP, in the foreign policy dimensions, that you're much stronger against China if you're united against China, that China can exploit one-on-one bilateral relationships. They can give you, hey, a promise that we're going to help you with this sorts of financing, or we're going to buy X, Y, and Z from you. And then if they turn around and stiff you, you know, one country is just going to be alone fighting against China to get its money back or whatever. Whereas if, you know, the European Union demands that any deals with China have to adhere to X, Y, and Z, labor regulations, environmental regulations on down the line, that will keep China, it will force China to make meaningful changes to the way it does business before it makes any deals in Europe. And here Italy is sort of weakening that unity by going off and deciding to strike a one-on-one deal. So, and I would also just point, there is sort of an irony here that these governments that the U.S. has been so supportive of under President Trump, Italy and Hungary, are now suddenly not making decisions that square with our China policy, right? You know, it's great to get these, you know, far-right governments in that are going to stick it to the European Union, you know, sort of big government kind of stuff that they are always warning about in Brussels. And then, lo and behold, you put those people in office and they're going to defend their sovereignty just like Trump defends their sovereignty and say, hey, these are our decisions to make. We're not going to listen to U.S. pressure here. So you kind of get what you paid for.
Yeah, and look, the Chinese with a lot of our money, they're buying a lot of the world. I mean, they're expanding quickly. And, you know, you talk about empire, they're building it.
Yeah, it's a pretty modern version of that, and it's stunning to see it. And we're spreading. That's 10 countries, I think, in Europe that have signed on. Italy's one of the bigger economies. It's a founding member of the European Union. So I think a lot of people were thinking perhaps we would draw the line here, and clearly they haven't. So the expansion of this Silk Road empire continues, whether or not it's a good thing or not, I think remains to be seen.
And finally, Venezuela. Evidently, we're pulling all of our diplomats out of Venezuela.
Yeah, we are. It seems like a relatively straightforward decision. I mean, it's a country that is embroiled in chaos right now, political, economic. Clearly, they're now in 6 days of basically nationwide power outages. People, I just was watching some video from the New York Times showing people basically pushing past or, you know, fighting past a National Guard battalion and forcing their way into a supermarket to ransack it. I mean, things are getting desperate. And yet, I think many folks I've talked to today would say, you know, we should have just pulled these diplomats out a long time ago. We kept them there under this sort of purported logic that doing so would bolster the opposition, right? That if, you know, we're not there to talk to Maduro, we're going to keep diplomats in Venezuela, our essential staff, so that they can coordinate with the opposition and push for regime change. And so at a, you know, what otherwise the U.S. would be talking about as a pivotal time for regime change and for the opposition in that country, our decision to pull out seems like we were sort of undermining that purported agenda before. I think what's also concerning here, so in that respect, given the security situation in the country, it's not crazy to actually make this move.
No, it's the right move.
Weird. What's that?
I think it's the right move. Get out.
Yeah, no. I mean, these people do not appear to have been very successful in helping, you know, Guaido in any way, if that's even a good policy. And what's the point of putting their families in extreme hardship just to make a political statement? On the other hand, as much as it's a very legitimate, you know, common sense decision to pull these people out, Pompeo's tweet on Monday evening announcing this did seem to be quite, you know, turned a lot of heads. He said that the, one of the reasons the diplomats were coming home was because they had, quote, become a constraint on U.S. policy, end quote, which reminded many people of, you know, these this long string of instances where the administration seems to be holding the door open to sort of possibly military intervention, something which could really change the tides in that country. And remember, John Bolton walked out into the White House press room with a yellow notepad saying 5,000 troops to Colombia. Now you have you had President Trump saying, you know, military invasion was, quote, an option. And now we have Pompeo sort of implying that maybe one of the reasons the diplomats would need to get out is because we know about some threat that's coming down the pipeline. That said, I've talked to some security experts today. They don't think any U.S. military plans are in the work. They don't see any of the sort of preliminary steps that might be setting that up.
Yeah.
But at the very least, it's just sort of part of this continual logic, which I think is quite flawed coming from the White House, that if we keep turning up the heat, that it's going to get to a boiling point and suddenly regime change is going to be ushered in. By most accounts, that's not happening. You know, all of our planned efforts, that aid push, the big protests, the return of Guaido to the country, like we keep thinking, or the Trump administration keeps saying that because of their pressure and their influence, that this is all about to come to a head. And there's just really no evidence of that. So, you know, it almost, even if it's not really the prelude to a U.S. military invasion, it sort of shows a naivete, I think, on the part of the American logic about the crisis in Venezuela, and just shows that we, you know, it exposes that we actually don't have anywhere near as much influence as that country as we thought we did.
No, and look, did you see the thing last week with Elliot Abrams? He was punked by a couple of Russians posing as Swiss diplomats.
No, but are they the radio guys? Because they've done that to a bunch of people.
They punked him, and he basically came out and said, "There's going to be no military. We're not invading. We're going to do some economic sanctions. We're going to put some pressure on. But there's no way in hell we're moving in with troops." And I, you know, look, I think, you know, duh. I think most of us got that, because I don't think as a country we don't have the stomach for something like that. I don't think, if it lasts longer than 15 minutes.
Well, and I'm glad for that.
Me too. There you go. Luke, I appreciate the time. Always great talking with you.
Thank you. Take care.
Our good friend Luke Vargas, Talk Media News. Make sure you check out his podcast, The World in Two, which you hear here on The Rick Smith Show. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.